time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
There could never be a portrait of my love, for nobody could paint a dream you will never see. A portrait of my love, for miracles I've never seen. Anyone who sees her soon forgets the Mona Lisa. It would take, I know, a Michelangelo, and he would need the glow of dawn that paints the sky above to try and paint a portrait of my love. It would take, I know, a Michelangelo, and he would need the glow of dawn that paints the sky above to try and paint a portrait of my
I know, I appreciate the Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness is in the box office and it's doing very well. And Natasha's been to see it already and she's already got lots of things to say about it. But I'm sorry, Natasha, we'll have to wait until Richard goes off to Holland. It's easily confused. Holland next week, or the Netherlands, one of the two things, to actually sort through the whole process. It may well be he'll be heading off to Hollywood shortly, just on the back of these far and wide-ranging scenarios. You know, you're the only one who does know what I've predicted ahead for his two scores for this week. Who knows where we'll actually go? Maybe we should start off with the Royal Society of Portrait Painters to actually sort of set the scene, Richard. What say you?
Yes, it's an exhibition I've promoted for 20 years, and it's a very large show, 200 portraits, and also this year, a very, very special royal wall to commemorate the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, which over the 70 years that she's reigned over us, this represents five of the decades, and also seven members of the Society's Portraits of the Queen, but also the 1969 Antigone, which was somewhat iconic. So that gave a special cachet to the exhibition, but it's always absolutely fascinating to wander around because, you know, portraiture, the ideal portrait captures the character of a sitter. And you've got this very intimate relationship between the artist and the sitter, and we're privileged to interpret it. And it's absolutely fascinating the way people choose to be painted, and also what you might think the artist, say, thinks of the sitter, or how the sitter reflects current trends in their and in what they wear. Why did they choose such and such a pose and so on? So I've always found with a mother who was a portrait painter, I've always been fascinated by the genre, and it's also a very good one to debate. Not that I have much time, because when you do the publicity, it's a job that stretches back over several months. But yes, it really was lovely to, after 2 years of COVID, when we were very lucky to have the exhibition 1 year in September, but usually it's in May, but this was a large-scale, spectacular opening and wonderful to be part of it, and also to see such a variety of portraits. Obviously, there's some you like, obviously, there's some you don't like. The prize winners, this is always, you know, does one agree, does one not? It varies tremendously. I would mark out for special attention the Prince of Wales's Drawing Prize and the winner of that, which I thought was linked to the, or reminiscent to the old masters. And very, very unusual winners usually, but as a show, very, very impressive. And certainly I'd mentioned that the £40,000 worth of prize money, that's huge, but there isn't a competition, because the BP Portrait Award, which of course had so much money behind it, you know, you went into the tubes and you found there were posters and so forth. It was known nationally. That, for reasons linked to environmental pressures, no longer exists. So this is the only exhibition.
But surely, Richard, BP are one of the most environmentally friendly organisations in the world. I mean, they're already making billions. And look what they've actually managed to save with respect to, obviously, their profits in the first few months of 2022 alone. I mean, you know, on that basis, it's not surprising they've had to actually cut their cloth accordingly and avoid such frivolities as, you know, when they're making billions of profits, shelling out £40,000 prize for the Royal Society of Portrait Painters. It's understandable.
It wasn't the BP that had anything to do with the Royal Society of Portrait Painters. The BP Portrait Award was a special exhibition held each year at the National Portrait Gallery. And as I say, it no longer exists, because BP and those who believe that it's defiling the environment, I mean, it was these pressures.
Stop oil now.
Well,
I'm speaking, as you can tell, obviously, from a city which is making use of its carbon effect and its greenhouse effect, simply because I didn't actually take down the New York Real Talk banner. I just thought we'd keep it up there. What the heck?
Well, I can only tell you that it's nice to see portraiture alive and well, and also the royal examples of it, because one of the things with any genre, you want debate, you want works brought to the public's attention, and one of the ways to do this is when the Queen is painted, and she's been painted 140 times. We don't know what she thinks of the individual works. Some of them, like Lucian Freud's, have been highly controversial, but really, it's really, really good to see such a complete variety of all sorts and types of portraits. It really adds to the way portraiture has managed to re-establish itself, because over the last century and 30 years, since 1891, 24 artists left the Royal Academy, and they included Whistler and Millais, and subsequently Augustus John joined. There have always been women members, but in a large part of the last century, portrait painting, traditional figurative portrait painting, because that's the purpose of the society, is to further excellence in portraiture, was very sidelined, especially with the argument that photography fulfilled the purpose of portraiture, and also, of course, the fact that the art world was dominated by critics and the market for those who supported the more contemporary types of art, various for abstract work and so forth. So there have been very strong pressures, but nonetheless, after Tate Modern and the Turner Prize, I think the contemporary art world is a great deal more confident, because the problem always was that it was felt that most ordinary people preferred the figurative, but on the other hand, and the contemporary did feel somewhat threatened, that they don't now. So I think it's an easier environment for portraiture. And as I say, these are not portraits that you'll find just in academic institutions and palaces and city guilds and so forth. It's a complete mix, and that's what it should be.
Richard, I have only had my portraits produced once. I was 4 years of age at the time. It was Mrs. Lavinia Capes, an artist who obviously destroyed her career completely just on the basis of that sitting alone, which is fine. I've taken that as a sort of template for life in all sorts of other bits and pieces. Presumably, as your mum was a portrait painter, you will have actually had many sittings in your own experience. So, yes, I'm not of that. But let's turn to the next generation, the generation basically of the instant gratification of the snapshot, the photograph and so on. Natasha Wanton, is this not just a case of, really, if you want to actually have a graphic narrative, just go to the works of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko and go for, satire or various other lines? Why would we actually have a portrait done of ourselves?
Look, I mean, I am a great appreciator of the arts. I love photography. My mother-in-law's a photographer. How can I not appreciate a good photo, particularly wildlife photography? I also do very much appreciate fine art. I have once sat for a portrait. It was like one of those street artists in Paris. And you know what? I actually really enjoyed that experience and I really treasure that picture. I still have that picture. I've brought it across, traveled with me a bit now, but I brought it across with me to Australia. And I do think there's something very lovely about capturing the essence of someone in a moment in time. And yes, you can get that with a photograph and with all the filters and all the editing and everything, you can make yourself look quite lovely.
Natasha, we don't have any filters or editing when I do the snapshots for Facebook or the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. People go in completely cold, as Richard will attest to.
Usually with me pulling a random face, Alex, if you've got anything to do with
it captures the moment.
Indeed. But no, I do think there is something very special about having someone who's talented and just capturing that person's face in a medium other than photography. I think that it gives you a different effect, and I think it can be very beautiful too. Both are very valid.
Rebecca Bond,
Add, if I may, that it's not just it's photography that captures the moment. Regarding sittings, portrait can gestate over a very long
period. Richard,
it
surely depends on how quick the artist is. I mean, some people can actually capture it within seconds.
Well, no, they don't actually. No, that is totally untrue. The average portrait would take, say, 4 to 6 sittings of 2 hours, and whereas certain portraits could be painted from photographs, you could have all sorts of varieties, obviously. I leave you with this example, and that was Lucien Freud and Brigadier Andrew Parker Bowles, the former husband of Camilla. 60 sittings for that one.
Yeah, but that's just excessive, Richard. That's just bourgeois excess. Let's move on to Rebecca Bond. From your own perspective, Rebecca, in Norwich, is this something which you think, yes, absolutely, I and indeed many of my friends have automatically got about 6 or 8 hours that we can actually put to one side just to have our portraits done?
Do you know what? I've never had my portrait done, and I would absolutely love to. And I think there's something that an artist can capture in a person that a camera cannot. And it'd be really interesting to sit down and see the kind of the features and the shadows that the artist picks out about your face. You know, a camera just gives you things as it is, but I think a portrait is very unique to the artist that produces it. And also, you know, you might be in a landscape. You know, you can edit things in ways that I think is a lot more valuable than a camera. So I would love to get my portrait done, but I have not yet.
And yet somehow, can a portrait ever capture the magic of a TikTok video? I don't know. Yes. Maybe from your own perspective, as the young lady who actually introduced me to the magic of TikTok when you were a level 1 first year student, reading, of course, communications and public relations at the University of Lincoln. Now, of course, back to graduate. And you were basically raving about TikTok in one of our last seminars before, in fact, we went into lockdown. But there we are. What are your views on portraiture and so on?
I still think the art is definitely something that I love. I participate in some film photography myself, and I think just the individual medium itself has so many unique attributes that still are defined by the unique person. And I think just that within itself is lovely. So I wouldn't mind having myself a portrait. know.
Well, who knows, Richard? Maybe it could be a growing form that could be reinstated as a way forward, more than just the street artist of Natasha's experience. Was it in Paris, did you say, Natasha, the street artist was?
Yes, it was up on Montmartre, up on the hill.
Yeah. Well, there we are. Fascinating. Let's move to something which was reviewed last week. And of course, last week, Natasha, The Lost City. We've clearly managed to persuade Richard to actually make the journey to actually see Sandra Bullock in action with Channing Tatum, both obviously greats of the cinematic world. And let's find
Alex, sorry, I misheard that last sentence. Would you please rephrase?
Yes, greats of the cinematic world.
Sorry, Alex, I misheard that last sentence.
I think both of his butt cheeks are certainly greats of the cinematic world. I saw those in abundance in that movie. That was wonderful.
And that's true portraiture.
Sorry, I genuinely didn't hear that. What was it?
Cheeks, buttocks, basically, Richard. Gluteus maximus, if we wish to be sort of profound, those belonging to Channing Tatum. So, Richard, what did you make of this little epic of the contemporary cinematic world?
Firstly, it isn't an epic. And secondly, I know that I and the team don't always see eye to eye when it comes to jungle cruises and also, in this case, lost cities. I mean, Natasha, it was on your recommendation. I repeat, it was on your recommendation that I suffered 2 hours of this terrible movie. I have to be honest. I mean, it's directed by Aaron and Adam Nee. And, I wish this movie had been lost, quite honestly, because it has a very poor script. And this is feeble flim-flam. And we're looking at two performers. And I admit I am not over-enamored of Sandra Bullock. She's very good, I think, in Gravity, but frankly, let's say it's Hugh Grant, pairing Hugh Grant.
But Richard, Speed and Speed 2 have to be some of the 20th century's greatest cinematic offerings. I mean, those two aspects alone probably put the entire oeuvre of David Lean to bed. You know, Speed 2.
Firstly, I don't know them. And secondly, they're not aspects. They sound like two movies, if they are what I think they are, that I will avoid. I'm not a Sandra Bullock fan. And also, this is supposed to be an action-adventure comedy, I quote. Well, firstly, with comedy, Sandra Bullock has never had the ability to carry off lines.
Oh, Richard, Miss Congeniality? Miss Congeniality 1, Miss Congeniality 2? Good grief.
Yes, good grief indeed, I should imagine. I haven't seen them either, and I'm not sure you have. I don't think you have. I don't think you've seen
them. Well, I think you'll find I'm very much mistaken in that, Richard. William Shatner's incarnation in Miss Congeniality 1 is awesome.
You refuse to say what you have seen and not seen, Alex, and that damages your credibility when you're attempting to attack, which is what you are. I would point out that the problem with Channing Tatum, I mean, he's a sort of muscle-bound hunk who, yes, in a movie like Foxcatcher, where he played an athlete, that he was perfectly good in that, and it was a good film. But here, I mean, apart from the, you know, he's a leech, I would suggest, quite frankly. There's a memorable scene with leeches. You referred to it already. Quite honestly, here we have billionaire Daniel Radcliffe. Oh, dear, as I think he was called Fairfax. The problem with the plot, in case anyone wonders about it, we meet Sandra Bullock as Loretta Sage. She's a reclusive middle-aged author who writes romance adventure novels, and it so happens that one of these novels deals with the location of the Crown of Fire, a priceless treasure in a remote Atlantic island. And Fairfax, played by Daniel Radcliffe, he can be excellent, but my God, he can be in some terrible films. He's a billionaire obsessed with finding it, kidnaps her, takes her to the island. The point with this, unfortunately, regarding the plot, is it simply doesn't matter what the plot is. And the reason it doesn't matter is that none of it makes sense. People, hitmen come and appear at will, get knocked out. The couple Bullock and Tatum do their own thing. Even the CGI in this movie is terrible, because when they do find whatever it may happen to be they're chasing, i.e. the Lost City, it doesn't even look convincing. I remember with Jungle Cruise...
But Richard, that's a very sophisticated line, because they've actually made it not look convincing in a way that only Bertolt Brecht could have actually applied in his classic Distanciation, where you make the audience aware of the artifice. So I say hats off to Tatum and Bullock for actually exploring a new and dynamic area of art form.
Well, I can only say, Alex, that that convoluted argument is no doubt excellent in theory. Firstly, when you haven't seen the movie, and secondly, if you had, and you've no intention of seeing it either, you're just having fun. I can see in your expression that I am able to see it at the moment. But the trouble is with this movie, Natasha, I was actually able to see it because I was trapped in the cinema, and therefore had to see all 2 hours of it. And whereas it is perfectly harmless, you want to have a look at the cast and enjoy this sort of thing. I remember the Jungle Cruise, which I enjoyed the first part of, but there you've got a lively pairing between the hunk and also Emily Blunt. That worked.
The Rock, not the hunk, the Rock.
Oh, the hunk, the Rock, no, yes.
It's Richard the Hunk Williams, Dwayne the Rock Johnson. We need to be clear.
Yes, Tom, well, I'm glad that that's clarified. Regarding Jungle Cruise, it was when the conquistadors came or creaked to life that movie creaked to a standstill for me. But I quite enjoyed part of it, certainly the first part of it. But here you haven't even got the chemistry. These are static cartoon characters. But on the other hand, if you like an action adventure comedy with them, and the movie has made money, that point has to be made, conceded point, Natasha, that has made quite a lot of money. Now, that is no mean feat for a film these days. If anyone likes it, for God's sake, go to it, because more people who see movies, the better I am pleased, and the fewer movies like this that I see, the better I am pleased too.
Okay, so Natasha, your score, once again, remind us for The Lost City was?
I gave it a 7. I thought it was fun. I really enjoyed this movie. I love Daniel Radcliffe as a villain, as like a cheesy, really bad old school, like cliche villain. I thought he was really good fun. His lines were brilliant. I thought there was some real gems in there. I had a really good time. I'm sorry, Rich. I knew the minute I found out Alex sent me through the list for today, I'm like, didn't I say to you, Alex, I'm like, he's going to hate this one. He's going to really hate this movie.
Two. Richard, it's getting 2 out of 10.
Wow.
Wow.
So even substantially lower than what I thought he was going to give. I thought he might have gone to a 6, but no.
Yeah.
He's dropped that considerably. Mm. Okay. Well, I mean, Rebecca, on that basis, are you Team Wanton or are you Team Fitzwilliams?
It's difficult. I don't usually opt for comedies unless I want something really easy that isn't too demanding on the brain. But I tend to like sort of...
You've just handed in your essay for comparative media histories. You need to have some relaxing stuff, surely.
Exactly. I would watch it on that basis, but I do tend to opt for something that makes me think, you know, something a bit more I can get involved with. So it depends how I'm feeling. I might, if I need a bit of escapism, but I think...
And it's got Sandra Bullock in, basically. Yeah. Rebecca Bond lookalike. Yeah. So marvellous. You know, works on that sort of ways. Yaz?
I'm sorry, Richard, but I am definitely going to give it a go.
Yeah, absolutely. I always said they've got excellent taste in The Joys of Bermuda. It's just the way forward. It ticks out every box on that movie, which is excellent stuff. So well done. Presumably, Richard, the likelihood of you going to see Sonic the Hedgehog 2 is also pretty remote, I would have thought.
Yes, Alex, it is.
Okay, well, let's move on to Happening, which, of course, you might describe as a classic 1960s moment. But no, you'd be wrong to do that, because you'd say, no, it's the November 24th, 2021 Audrey Diwan adaptation of Annie Emer's eponymous novel, looking back on her experience with abortion when it was still illegal in France in the 1960s. Off you go, Richard.
Now, this is a film that I would recommend. It is really, really tough viewing, but I mean, this is a remarkable film. Audrey Diwan directs and co-writes. Happening is set in 1963. I have to say, when I was watching the film, I thought it was set in the 50s. And I had no idea that abortion wasn't legalized in France until 1975. And I mean, yes, it is indeed based on a novel, and indeed this packs a punch. I mean, this is really powerful. We meet Anne, a young and talented student. She gets pregnant, and the film examines what happens. And this is a movie where, I mean, set in France with subtitles, of course. It could, I mean, this is almost as France as some occupied, not obviously by the Nazis, but by a patriarchal regime, which is absolutely ruthless, because the Anne's dilemma, she wants, does not want to keep the child, so how can she find someone who will help her to get an abortion? Because the problem is anyone helping her could end up in jail. So she goes to doctors. Now she goes to one doctor who doesn't let his personal sympathy be obvious. He gives her medication, and that in fact turns out that it's going to strengthen the embryo to make it more difficult to have an abortion. Certainly she can't by herself abort, and there is a sympathetic doctor, but he's too afraid because of the law. And what was so amazing about this movie, visually very impressive, is that it's the shockingly Puritan, rigid confines of the society at that time. The moment the subject comes up, fear predominates. And she's absolutely determined to end this pregnancy. But who will help her? What about the father of the child, Jean, played by Casey Muttet Kline? What about her? Dare she mention it to her parents? Sandrine Bonnaire, well-known French actress, plays her mother. Jacques is her dad. Would they help? And there's this increasing sense of panic because she knows her entire existence may well rise or far more likely fall on this one issue. It is quite an extraordinary film because of the atmosphere and the tension that's built up while she, to say that she examines the various ways that she can terminate doesn't do the scenes justice. You're really put through the, insofar as you can on a screen, with close-ups and with very, very graphic scenes. It has to be mentioned that I think quite a lot of viewers, I was alone in the cinema, even these days, doesn't tend to happen often. There are scenes here which a lot of people would find very disturbing and upsetting, they're intentionally so. And there's contemporary relevance, of course, because as you all know, the Supreme Court is going to rule in Roe versus Wade, and half the states in America are going to ban abortion, according to reports. So it couldn't be more relevant. It couldn't have come at a time when this is an issue that's being really hard fought out. And it's got a very, very powerful documentary feel to it. And I have to say the performances, simply absolutely amazing. Anna Maria Vartimalli as Anna is unbelievable. For those who could sit through it, because not everybody can or would, in my opinion, it's an amazing, it's a social document. But you consider that this was nearly 60 years ago in France, consider parts of it coming back to the United States pretty well now, indeed already have in some states, it's being debated and discussed. So, I mean, this gets a 10 simply because it's such an extraordinary social document, and it's a very, very powerful film about, obviously, a woman's right to choose, but equally what society, and also she's at school, she is a one of three. They're, they hang out together and so on, and they confide, obviously, about intimate matters. But when it comes to this, how do her friends respond? It's quite extraordinary, this film. So I can see why it was so highly praised. It got a BAFTA nomination, but it's only just opened in London. It isn't the sort of film that most people will want to see, but it's a film that a lot of people should see. Certainly, it chills the blood, if you consider what she goes through.
Yes, is this one for you?
I would definitely say yes. I agreed with everything that Richard said. It's definitely something that needs to be watched. You know, I think it's something that you should take your time out to take into appreciation, even if it's something that you do not necessarily agree on. Hopefully, like, this can open up new ways or new points of views for that person in that sense. So I think it's perfect timing.
Rebecca?
This sounds a lot more up my street. Like I said, I like things that make me think, and this is a really relevant issue when you consider what's going on in the news at the moment, and it's constantly coming around about these laws and things like that. So for me, I think it's really important to watch these things and see what people go through. And yeah, I want to sit and watch and be enraged and, you know, judge the system that is still in place today. So yeah, I'll be watching this one.
And Natasha, I suspect it'll be a yes from yourself as well.
Yes. Firstly, I was very, very happy to find out this wasn't a horror film. Looking at the title, I was like, oh no, has Richard gone down the horror route again? Although I suppose it's kind of tragic in a way, because the real horror is that stuff like this is still happening today and very much in debate. And you just think, wow, 60 years, so much has happened and so very little has happened. But no, yeah, I will definitely be watching this film. This is something I feel very strongly about. And it's something I think a lot of people who maybe, you know, as Yaz said, if you know, regardless of your opinion, maybe it's something that we could watch, because just because someone has an opinion, you know, seeing the other side is also quite nice to see as well. So it's nice to see, you know, perspective and education is always good.
Okay, so briefly looking ahead to next week, when Richard will be in Europe, that's in the part of Europe that's still actually connected with the EU, as opposed to the excluded from Europe, but still part of, well, let's not go there. Natasha, Multiverse of Madness and Doctor Strange, is it another return to form for the MCU Phase 4?
Oh, definitely. I should be jumping up and down on my soapbox a little bit. So just prepare yourself for that one, Alex. But no, I'm very much looking forward to discussing this and the controversial critical response to it as well.
Okay. And Rebecca, is this one that appeals to yourself, or is it a case of, no, it's far too populist?
No, certainly. I'm going to see this next Friday, I believe, upcoming Friday. So I shall be there with my opinions.
And yes, now that you've clearly submitted your dissertation, that's now gone in, been sorted from there, you're now just gearing up for the delights of strategic communications and values issues and crisis management. What are your thoughts on Multiverse of Madness?
I think it's definitely interesting. Doctor Strange is not one of the Marvel shows I've watched. So
by the hoary hosts of Hogarth. Benedict Cumberbatch little impression there for the benefit of the non-visual radio listener. There we are. So will you be seeing it before Natasha reviews it next week?
Hopefully.
Richard, presumably this is one of those which you think maybe, maybe not, I don't know, after I've been destroyed in Natasha's recommendations for The Lost City. If she rates it, then clearly there could be a complete challenge to my critical faculties here. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that I would only fond of Natasha, that I undoubtedly am. No two critics could agree all the time on the same movies. It would have taken absolute run of disagreements to set such thoughts in motion. No. I mean, obviously, one of the joys of movies is that, you know, there's so much scope for disagreement, that we all like different things from time to time. It is interesting. Critics, of course, for years have had so much less sway. But I think that with social media, I don't know the percentage, but it would be, and of course we've had the pandemic, it's very, very difficult, but it would be interesting to know whether critics, so far as tweets are concerned, so far as podcasts are concerned, the influence I'd love to know that they have, if they do, on cinema and on the way people go, or as often happens, don't go. But of course, again, right behind all this is the fact that, you know, I think the happening, I saw the cinema, but it should be online. So most of you hopefully will be able to see it soon. I mean, it's what we don't have, at least as far as I know, is are the figures of viewers once the movie goes online and how many see it and how many see it.
But Richard, you'd already be celebrating because Netflix are basically close to bankruptcy because they've lost all of their Russian subscribers now and they won't be able to sort of scratch two beans together with the...
Alex, there's a lot more. That's a simplistic summary if ever there was one. There's a lot more to Netflix's collapse than just their losses in Russia. I mean, they're actually going to, apparently they're considering advertising, they're cutting back. No doubt there will be increases in subscriptions. And I mean, we may well be seeing a change also to people's viewing online, evident in the coming months, because they were so confident. Even Megan's series, Pearl, an animated series, has
I know you're devastated by that, Richard. You're really looking forward to that exploration of positive role models through the ages. Never mind.
If I might,
Richard, though, just as a bit of positivity, if it makes you feel a little bit better about life. Yesterday, the cinema I went to, there was 20 viewings for Doc Strange. And the only tickets I could get out of all those 20 viewings was the last one at 9:50. There were no two seats together in the rest of those 20 viewings all day. And that's just one cinema in the city. That makes you feel better about life.
Because it's so important. Because cinema has had to fight. And you know, with movies, even The Lost City, for example, as I say, it made quite a lot of money. It's so important because the sort of films that I have to admit I prefer. I mean, I have here an article, and it's the Daily Telegraph, and it says, "Why I have never watched a Marvel movie." Well, and the fact is,
I think the key words there, Richard, Daily Telegraph. Okay, I don't think you need to go much beyond that to see where the editorial pitch is going to be.
I object, Alex. May I say that the key words which weren't in your last sentence and should have been are media bias, because in fact it's not what a paper says. It's they allow a certain amount of latitude, all the reporters do, whether it's The Guardian, The Telegraph, even The Mail sometimes. It's not what the paper's angle generally is. It's what an individual columnist actually said. And you, I suspect, would judge that columnist without
Richard,
even...
Richard, I think Charles Moore is a very well-balanced individual. I think Charles's views on the current government and the opposition are absolutely spot on. And Camilla Tominey, I think, is an absolutely ace individual for writing in so many delightful ways. So, you know, it's just we know where we're coming from. Neither Camilla nor Charles will be big fans of indeed the wondrous world of Marvel movies. William Sitwell, with that William Sitwell's weekly column in the Daily Telegraph on Saturday, it'd be lost without sorts of things, basically. I don't think William's going to be seeing a Marvel movie either. I'm just saying, Daily Telegraph, you kind of know the people who are writing for them that they're not going to have it on their list.
That does not negate the rights or wrongs of what they say, does it?
But you're off to Holland, so who knows what's going to happen in that particular side of things, Richard. So we'll see you in a fortnight's time. I still prefer photographs. That's why we're having wishing I had a photograph of you in a few moments. But for now, Natasha Wanton, Rebecca Bond, Yaz de Graaf, and Richard Fitzwilliams, huge thanks. A feature on sepsis coming up next. Yes, I'll say that again, sepsis. So until then, keep watching the movies.
It's not the way.
Sepsis, you may well have heard of it, or then again, you may not have heard of it, in which case you wouldn't be in the isolation there, because the UK Sepsis Trust is obviously keen to raise awareness of this whole scenario in terms of content and so on, and indeed the 10th anniversary of the UK Sepsis Trust itself. And so we're delighted to welcome the head of communities at UK Sepsis. Of course, that's Terence Canning with us. How are you, Terence?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's absolute pleasure. Now, would you like to share with us a little bit about what sepsis actually is and what indeed the UK Sepsis Trust is all about in terms of how this copes with the challenges of life?
Sure. What I'll start with is, I'm not medical, but I'll give you a very hopefully good layman's description of what sepsis is. So essentially, sepsis is what happens when your immune system overreacts to an infection. And this could be any infection, something serious like a chest infection like pneumonia, or something very common like a urinary tract infection, or even a cut on your finger that becomes infected. So what happens then is your body overreacts and it attacks its own organs and tissues. And if sepsis isn't treated quickly and diagnosed quickly, it can result in organ failure and death. And, you know, the figures are around 40,000 people each year in the UK die from sepsis. So what we try to do as a charity is raise awareness with the public, raise awareness with health professionals to give people the best chance of the best outcome. Because the more you know about sepsis, the quicker you can react, the quicker you can be diagnosed, and the quicker you can be treated.
And indeed, for 40% of all cases of survivors, effectively are also left with permanent life-changing after effects as well. So is that all down to the speed of diagnosis and the way in which things can actually be moved quickly to hopefully ensure that as far as possible a return to normality is facilitated?
Absolutely. I mean, sepsis, much like stroke, I guess, is a very time critical illness. But the pivotal moment of sepsis isn't always as identifiable as it might be with something like stroke. So the need for people to be diagnosed quickly, to recognize themselves quickly and seek medical attention quickly is the key thing. Because the quicker you diagnose and treated, the better chances you have of the best outcome. So some of the symptoms of sepsis, for example, if you're in the community and sepsis is 80% community acquired, would be something like slurred speech or confusion, extreme shivering or muscle pain, passing no urine in a day is a key one, or severe breathlessness, anything like that, any worries around infection. We would encourage people to either dial 111 or contact a GP, or if seriously worried, call 999 or visit A&E and just ask, you know, the question, could this be sepsis? Very simple question, but it could save a life.
And the UK Sepsis Trust is also partnering with Green Flag to actually raise this awareness. Would you like to just talk about the live stream and indeed what's happening with respect to this as well?
Yeah, sure. A Green Flag will partner with us on helping us produce this video. And the idea behind the live stream is to give a voice and a face to the thousands of people that are affected by sepsis each year. This particular video is a combination of 100 real life case studies. This story is told by Warwick Davis, who we're delighted to have involved. We hope by using these individual stories, we'll create enough of an impact to raise awareness around this devastating condition.
The UK Sepsis Trust is obviously a go-to part to find this whole thing. Is sepsistrust.org the best website location to find the video as well?
Yeah, if you want any information generally around sepsis or to access our very good support services, www.sepsistrust.org is the place to go. For the live stream as well, if you follow us on our social channels, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, we'll be very visible on there. So if you can encourage your listeners to do either of those two things, and that would be wonderful.
And what brought you to the charity yourself, Terence? Was it a personal story? Was it just a case of, well, it looked interesting? What was your own life path for this particular area?
It's Alex. It's a very much a personal story. It's the 10th anniversary of the charity this year, and it just happens to coincide with the 10th anniversary of my losing my brother Mark. Now, Mark was only 41, and he was married with a 3-year-old child. He had community acquired sepsis. He didn't realize he had that. I was around my brother at the time, and I also didn't realize he had that. So even though I was part of his journey through A&E, etc., I didn't have the information or the knowledge that I have now to behave in the way I would have liked to. So what I like to do or try to do now via the UK Sepsis Trust is give people that information to empower them to ask the questions that I was unable to ask. I mean, if I was in that situation again, I would behave very differently. I would ask about my brother's confusion. I would ask about the possibility of infection. And I would ask about the possibility of sepsis. I did not have the opportunity, but hopefully by doing this, we'll give the other people the chance to have the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So a reminder, it's sepsistrust.org to find out initial lines with respect to that. Terence, it's been great connecting with you, good stuff today. Huge thanks. Keep up the excellent work, Terence Canning, Head of Care, of course, at the Sepsis Trust. Huge thanks indeed, and be well.
Thank you very much, Alex. Pleasure to be involved. Thanks very much.
Purchasing a house is a huge decision, and if you're a first-time buyer, it might be even more daunting in terms of the challenges that people can actually face even getting onto the housing ladder. And yes, there's a cost of living crisis that's going on as well, and yes, fuel costs are going through the roof, and so on and so on and so forth. So how do we actually address this situation, especially if you are a first-time buyer and are looking to actually save that deposit and get things together to actually start owning the home of your dreams? Well, we're delighted to welcome Nationwide Senior Mortgages Manager to talk to us about this. That's the wonderful Paul Archer. How are you, Paul?
I'm fine, thank you, Alex. How are you this morning?
Good. And in terms of this particular routine, I mean, it's obviously always been a challenge to get on the housing market. Is it now in the third decade of the 21st century even more challenging than it used to be for our parents, our grandparents, and so on?
And that's the research that we've carried out over the last couple of months, and the results tell us that it's still a challenge. Like, as you say, it's always been a challenge for first time buyers, but with the recent cost of living increases that we're now seeing, 90% of first time buyers worried about the living costs escalating, harming their ability to save a deposit, and that a few of those will now have to delay purchasing a property for a couple of years in order to keep saving an adequate deposit. But that notwithstanding, 75% of first-time buyers are still managing to fund a deposit to purchase their own home. So the first-time buyer market is still absolutely resilient.
Yeah, that was something which really surprised me, because actually allowing for the fact that the deposit is still the biggest hurdle, in fact, over a quarter, 28% claim it's the most difficult part of home ownership to overcome. As you rightly said, Paul, three quarters of prospective first-time buyers managed to actually save the deposit themselves, possibly with a little bit of help from the bank of mum and dad.
Yes, absolutely. It was about 23% rely on financial help from their parents or grandparents or someone who's going to gift them at least part of their deposit. So it is a crucial part of the market. But I think the key part, or the key information from the research, would suggest that first time buyers are still managing to save the required deposit themselves, and nationwide we make sure that we're offering mortgage products which enable people to get onto the housing ladder with a relatively low deposit. We offer 95% LTV mortgages, loan to value mortgages, which enables customers to their deposit to go further.
Shared purchases, is that another route that more and more people are taking? And the classic line that it's two can live as cheaply as one, that not just if you're involved on a personal level, that actually a shared purchase can also be a way forward.
I mean, it comes down to a couple of things for first-time buyers. And there's the resilience of the first-time buyer market. We're seeing that people are either trying to boost their income or save their outgoings. And obviously, if you are purchasing with someone else, you boost the income you can use to buy the property. Again, another product that Nationwide have brought to market is our Helping Hand mortgage, which enables first-time buyers to borrow up to 20% more against their salary than would normally be available. So it's not an absolute prerequisite, but it's an avenue that many first-time buyers explore.
Now, one of the things that Nationwide has actually brought to the area is, of course, a first-time buyer resource package. So just share with us, Paul, what does that actually entail? What sort of things are actually in there, and how can it actually help somebody who might be listening to this or might know somebody who's looking to take those first tentative steps to owning their own home?
Yes, we have pulled together a first-time buyer hub on our website, which gives first-time buyers valuable information. It's a one-stop shop in terms of understanding sort of where to start the journey in terms of how much you could potentially afford and how to start looking for houses and making offers on property, all the way through to, you know, completing and moving in. So we have many different guides and information on the website, which help you help the first-time buyers navigate your specific journey into your first home.
And as Nationwide Senior Mortgages Manager, are you somebody who's never, ever had any challenges with such a field? Or is it just a case of, yeah, no, when I actually was searching, trying to buy my first property, it was a challenge as well?
Oh, no, it absolutely was. It was a challenge. I was fortunate to secure a job in an area where house prices weren't, you know, a massive multiple of my income, and I've, you know, lived with my now wife for over 20 years, and so we've definitely had some of the benefits of having sort of joint income and a place that, you know, wasn't super expensive. But we remember the struggles and the strains, particularly post university, of saving and making, you know, hard decisions about where to go on, you know, or if to go on holiday, and how much we're going to spend on our food budget in order to save enough to move into our first house.
Well, these days, just determining whether you should actually put petrol in your tank or purchase Chelsea Football Club, one of those two things, obviously, to the fore as well. Paul, nationwide.co.uk is presumably the best place to go to find out further details about what we've been chatting about today.
Absolutely. Navigate to the mortgages page and you'll be able to find the first-time buyer guides.
Paul Archer, Nationwide Senior Mortgages Manager. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much.